passed Senate Committee on General Government Tuesday, April 27, 1999, 3 p.m., hearing room C, Senator Vern Duncan, Chair.
Senate Bill 361.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 361 and Gross was sent to the floor, and we had floor discussion on the 29th of March, at which time it was sent back to our committee for consideration. The problem on the floor was related to the union leave portion of the bill. At this time, it's probably best if we remove that portion and insert it into DAS's union leave bill. We've been in conversation with PERS and DAS and the unions, and this is something that people have agreed to. So we can set 361 free, let the PERS bill go fly on its own, and come back on Thursday and work.
Chair, about the dash A2 amendment?
That would be the dash A2.
The chair, I'd move the dash A2 amendment.
Control motion, dash
A2 amendment
to 361.
Any concerns with that? Hearing none, the 8th Amendments are adopted. Chair, I move the bill as amended to forward Senate with two-pass recommendation.
Chair, I recommend
Chair, I'd like to get the pledge of each of you will speak, so I won't be alone. All you have to say is, do support it.
I can say that much. I'm not sure I understand the complexity.
And, you know, I think you'll recall, when the decision was made in September, we put two items together. That was a decision I left to both PERS and the union representatives. They made a decision. We'd given a try, but we wanted to be sure we didn't lose.
Yes,
you want. Okay?
Very important bill.
Very important bill.
So we'll move forward with that one. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 361. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 479.
Public hearing?
The work.
It's public hearing.
Anyone have
anything
to say on 479 at this point?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 479 was before us on the 22nd, at which time we heard from members of the homeless community and homeless activists. We do have the Dash 1 amendments before us that makes this permissive rather than required by municipalities.
Is there anyone to testify on it? Close the public hearing on 479, and I'll open the work session on 479.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 479.
Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 479 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair, move 479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Trump.
Aye.
Aye. 479 will become, as amended, will become the public hearing recommendation. Senator Shields, you are carrying the bill.
During the work session on 479.
And I'm going to open a
public hearing on 720. Oh, boy. 720.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 720 was before us at the beginning of the month, at which time Bonnie Tatum from the Public Utilities Commission came before us to explain the Dash 1 amendment. Since that time, and conversations with Bonnie Tatum and Northwest Natural, who is not represented here today, we came up with some other amendments, and those amendments went through Senator Shields' office. In your little packet, you should have the Dash 1, which we discussed on the 6th, and a copy of the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments.
Are these mutually exclusive amendments, or they do different things?
They are separate from each other.
Okay.
We have some people here that might be able to explain them.
Bonnie is here to please come forward. Good afternoon.
Senator Duncan?
Yes.
I know that my own staff didn't have time to check in, but they too could maybe help explain.
Oh, okay. You want to come on up?
My name is Bonnie Chagan, for the record. I'm here on behalf of the commission, and I can support at this time either the dash one amendment, which I gave you 3 weeks ago, or the dash four. Let me explain that in both cases, those amendments clarify that sales by public utilities providing natural gas and electricity for motor vehicle use are not deregulated. Unless they are not deregulated. In the dash four amendment, there is some things that they have, some hoops that companies have to go through. Unless the commission makes a finding that there is effective competition among providers of alternative fuels, and such sales are in the public interest. Essentially, this amendment ensures that sales for motor vehicle use by utilities such as Northwest Natural and Portland General Electric that are already providing natural gas and electricity for motor vehicles not unintentionally exempted from regulation. And the dashboard still does that. It is my understanding that both Northwest Natural and CGE have agreed to the language amending Senate Bill 720 in either form, dash 1 or dash 4. I also would like to indicate that the commission interprets dash 4 language to, and wants to clarify that sales of other alternative fuels such as ethanol, methanol, methane, and biodiesel that are not now considered subject to the commission's authority would not become subject to the commission's authority and would therefore not be expected to make a showing that these sales are in the public interest. Therefore, I had hurriedly suggested that a somewhat simple correction to the dash 4 might make dash 4 more accurate. But in any case, I think that, that we're okay and that that concludes my
testimony. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I didn't have anything to say. Oh, I'm sorry. Matthew Shields, for the record. I didn't have anything specific to say. I can try to answer questions about these three if you want. I apologize. There is some difficulties with the dash 4 members. This came out of council about noon today, so unfortunately a lot of people didn't actually see them until they came into this room this afternoon. Dash 4 was intended as a compromise between the dash 1 and the dash 3, and it inadvertently would appear to subject to regulation some substances which are not currently regulated, which is not probably something we want to be doing. On the other hand, it also probably doesn't matter, since no one's really selling these things right now. We're mostly just putting in statute in case someone wants to in the future, but it probably wouldn't significantly impact anybody anyway. We talked about this earlier. Our main feeling is just that any one of these three amendments, even the dash three, which is probably the worst of the three, would be a significant improvement on the status quo. So we are certainly encouraging the committee to pass whichever of these seems most appropriate, but we don't have an opinion as to which one.
Mr. Cadwell, my thing, I don't think 4 is fatally flawed and could work the way it is. It isn't maybe as proactive looking to the future and some new energy sources that may be out there someday. I'd be interested in all three of their opinions as to whether 4 is the best. I mean, it was intended to be the compromise.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Draining for the Oregon Office of Energy. We also support the bill. And I think the dash 4 is the best alternative. I think if we simply insert on line 9 after sale the word by public utilities, I think that takes care of the problem of unintended additional regulation, because that makes it clear the funding is related to public utilities. I think that would do what Senator Schiff is trying to do with the amendment, or whatever the term of art is that PSC uses regarding utilities.
I'm not sure that works in that I thought that part of the intent was to make sure that providers of the other alternative fuels would not become a public utility. And by just putting the sales by public utilities of those alternative fuels,
it doesn't clarify that sales by other than public utilities of those alternative fuels doesn't make those providers public utilities.
Pardon?
No. I think there's a fix that's needed, and I put a fix together. I shared it with Matthew, and I shared it with Matthew.
Is it too complicated to share with us as a committee?
No, I don't think so.
Well.
Okay. On the dash 4, line 9, I would propose that beginning with the word the third word, that become the first sentence in section 2. It would say the sale of ethanol, methanol, methane, biodiesel, or alternative fuel for use in a motor vehicle shall not be considered a sale by a public utility subject to regulation under this chapter. So in that sentence, all I've done is eliminate natural gas or electricity. Now, the second sentence would then be the first sentence, which is on line 6, beginning of line 6. If the Public Utility Commission finds that there is effective competition among, with the addition of two words, public utility providers of alternative fuels for use in motor vehicles, and that the sale of such alternative fuels is in the public interest, then those sales shall not be subject to regulation under this chapter.
So we've got a whole bunch to add to that sentence, right?
That's right.
Okay, let's just deal with something here. What committee?
Work session.
No, public hearing. But does the amendment, the suggested amendment for Bonnie just made, do you accept the desires of the committee more so than the others? And you are asking what are the committee?
Senator Shields, is he comfortable with them? I'd like to, sort of see them rather than hearing about them. Maybe we just need to come back to
them. Well, I think I would want them. I'd want to have them.
Yeah. I want to make, I guess I'm just uncomfortable that we have gone through 4 amendments, and I want to make sure that this is finally gets everybody happy, okay? And she's going to make a copy. It'll take a couple minutes. But what happened, I guess, unintentionally, and you can explain this again, was that we ended up with ethanol, methanol, biodiesel, methane, and other fuels being regulated that you didn't think ought to be regulated the way this is written. You understand what?
Senator Shields, you were correct that dash 4, as the Public Utility Commission put together, as the amendments that we put together that would then become dash 4, were helped out by legislative council and became this. So the dash 4 was the appropriate compromise, the way the language was originally intended to be written.
I just want to, remember the basis of this bill is so simple. Just to make it possible for a gas station to sell natural gas and not end up being regulated like a public utility, or to have a, at some point when we develop the technology, a recharging station for an electric vehicle. Can this become a hand engrossed?
Mm.
It can. Okay. All right. So do you want
to?
So let's just consider it, and then take it and get it drafted and bring it back. Is that possible?
That's what I want to find out, so you don't have to come back the
right
third time.
I don't want to do that again.
People have trouble, then you go ahead and have it.
The amendment's drafted, and then bring it back for work session and adoption.
So it reads, section 2 reads, the sale of ethanol, methanol, methane, biodiesel, or other alternative fuel for use in a motor vehicle shall not be considered a sale by a public utility subject to the regulation of this chapter. And then the next sentence, if the Public Utility Commission finds that there is effective competition among public utility providers of alternative fuels for use in motor vehicles, and that the sale of such alternative fuels is in the public interest, then those sales shall not be subject to regulation under this chapter. Is that right?
That makes all of you happy?
Mike, you need your own copy.
Do you think this amendment will require the PUC to make a finding for any seller of electricity or gas? And the intent of the bill was, at least originally, for non-utility entities to be able to sell natural gas as a fuel without being regulated. I'm not sure that an entity makers change it.
I don't understand. Go ahead.
Okay, at this point, I think the players are out
there, here. Since I have the three of them in one place, can I take it outside the door for a few minutes?
You still have a quorum.
Is that okay? Mm-hmm. I am ready to close the public hearing on 7:20, and we will be... We'll see it again very soon. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on 5:06. Good afternoon. You're going to wing it by yourself, don't you?
Take on the burden.
Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Identify yourself over there.
Well, my name is Richard Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z. Further identification in my testimony. Good afternoon, Chair Duncan and members of the committee. I am, as I said, Richard Schwartz, Executive Director of the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to share with the committee our testimony on Senate Bill 567. AFT Oregon is a statewide organization of local union affiliates of the American Federation of Teachers. We represent over 8,300 employees in both the public and private sectors, employed as classified employees in K-12 school systems, classified in faculty and community colleges, faculty and graduate teaching fellows in four-year institutions, child care workers, registered nurses, dental hygienists, and technical employees in healthcare. AFT Oregon requested the introduction of Senate Bill 567 in order to extend the period of contract bar for public employee collective bargaining agreements from a maximum of 2 years to a maximum of 3 years. What is a contract bar? It is a period of time related to the collective bargaining agreement and beginning when the contract is signed that protects the labor management relationship by ensuring a period of labor peace and stability. The policy of the state in ORS 243.656 reflects a recognition of the interest of the state in harmonious and cooperative relationships between government and its employees, acceptance of the principle of collective negotiation, and to assure orderly and uninterrupted operations and functions of government. In short, the purpose is stability. Contract bars are an extension of those basic principles. Once a question of representation is settled and a contract is negotiated, the governmental employer and its public employees should have some assurance that a collective bargaining agreement will provide that stability and uninterrupted labor peace. The contract bar concept provides that by limiting union rating and decertification elections during the term of the contract. It does not eliminate them, but it pushes them to the time near the expiration of the contract. Thus, contract bars are determined by mutual agreement of management and employee representatives and are memorialized in the form of the contract itself. Contract bars have been a part of the labor management condition since the National Labor Relations Act was instituted. It has been included in Oregon's collective bargaining statute at ORS 243.692. extent it's an enactment. The contract bar fixes the bargaining relationship, ensuring stability after public employers and unions have mutually agreed to the contract term. Under current standards, the contract bar is 3 years under federal law and 2 years under Oregon law. The difference is that under the National Labor Relations Act, that standard was developed through its case law adjudication. In Oregon, it is an explicit provision of the statute. Senate Bill 567 simply seeks to increase the contract bar in Oregon for public employees from 2 years to 3 years, bringing it in line with federal private sector standards. The current 3-year national private sector contract bar was established by the NLRB in its general cable decision. In that case, the NLRB stated, "In adopting a 3-year rule, we have heeded the appeals for a more extended contract bar period presented in oral arguments, letters, telegrams, memoranda, and briefs by the overwhelming majority of labor and management representatives." The citation I've listed there for reference. The practice in public employee contracts in Oregon has now reached a stage where contracts are having longer terms. 3 years has not been uncommon for quite a while. Now they are reaching 4 years and in some cases 5 years, often as a proposal from the public employer. And I did a little counting just on the number of contracts that we have just in the decade of the 90s. And we've had, we represent 18 locals and about, or have about 18 locals and about 24 bargaining units and collective bargaining agreements. 25 of those agreements just in the 90s have been 3 years. Four, and this is just in the last half of the 90s, have been for 4 years. And one of them is for 5 years. It began in 1995 and won't expire until next year.
Sure. Do you have any 2 years?
A few.
So what do you do about those if we extend this to 3? What happens with those? Contracts are for 2 years.
No, there will be no effect on those.
This won't have an effect.
Right.
It'll be 2 years for them.
Right. It would be the same if it were a 1-year agreement. The contract bar is the time, the fixed period of stability during which the Employment Relations Board won't entertain any kind of representation petition.
Yeah. Well, in a 2-year contract, do you have any contract bar?
There is a what's referred to in the business as a window period, and in the statutes and case determinations, and the window period is measured from the expiration of the agreement backwards. So it's roughly a 30-day period, not longer than 90 days from the expiration, nor shorter than 60 days from the expiration. So there's, I guess in short, you could say there's a 30-day period in the third month before the expiration or any time after the contract expires.
But increasingly, your contracts are for longer than 2 years and you have this new contract.
In fact, I in the negotiation session just last night at Hillsboro School District for the classified employees, the employer, in our first session, the employer proposed a 4-year agreement commencing this July 1. And last Friday, in a initial bargaining session at Columbia Gorge Community College for the faculty, the employer there also proposed a 4-year agreement beginning this July. So it's increasingly more that longer-term contracts are being proposed. That doesn't say, obviously, what the give and take of negotiations where it'll end, but it's fairly clear that it will be something in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 years.
Could I assume from what you're saying is that employer groups with whom you negotiate are not going to object to this bill?
We have had no objection from any of them, and I raised this with the employer's representative last night, her comment was that she couldn't imagine any employers being opposed to it.
Right. Is it going to cost more to do it this way?
No.
So there's no cost. So the cities and counties shouldn't come off the wall, or the school districts. You deal mostly with school districts.
School districts, community colleges, and higher ed institutions in the public sector. Actually, the cost, depending on what one means by cost, it's just in terms of the cost of negotiation. The longer the term, the less negotiation.
Will this change before all unions and all contracts with all groups?
I'm sorry?
Will this change be generally for more than just your group and your particular business?
So it's a proposed amendment to the collective bargaining statute.
Do you know of others who will, do you know of any of the other labor groups or employer groups who will be opposed to this?
We've checked with all that we know, which is all of them, and none are opposing this.
I guess on that same question, I guess, I don't even hear a question, are they...
I guess you could say that. They in fact, I talked to one of them yesterday, and they said they had no opposition to it. And our lobbyist has conferred with all of the major players and all of the other labor organizations. The AFL-CIO has no opposition to it. I didn't mention in my introduction that I'm a member of the board of the state Oregon State AFL-CIO.
Do you have any idea if key legislators understand it well enough to know whether they have objections or not?
I know of none that have an objection to it. There was a... they're all key legislators.
Well, if we went along with you and moved this bill out to the floor, would you make sure that people got to those legislators and explained it so that they wouldn't misapprehend what it does and come off the wall on it?
In fact, our lobbyist was taking care of some of that earlier today on a question from one you might refer to as a key legislator, had misunderstood its application to another entirely unrelated
I do too.
Frankly, I had, there was some difficulty as a general problem with fair, with long contracts because in the same in the same sense, long-term provides some labor stability. On the other hand, it's in the mathematics or the calculus of it is that at some point the length becomes problematical because the parties are unable to get in to resolve any of their issues. On the other hand, this bar that we're proposing for 3 years would still leave open the entire, it would provide for the window period, 3 months out from the expiration of the third year, or the entire fourth year would still be an open period and not be within the contract part.
Are there any other questions?
Chair, I have a fundamental question. Yes. AFT-O Oregon is known as American Federation of Teachers, but as I looked at the testimony, the copy you gave me, it includes all people, colleges, faculties, a fellow, four-year institution, child care workers, registered nurse, dental hygienist, technical employees, the name looks like it's leading to me.
Senator, through the chair, there one anecdotal comment is that if it went to school, it's our jurisdiction. But that aside, the American Federation of Teachers has five divisions and has expanded its jurisdiction. Those that it organized from the late 1970s on, there's the K-12 teacher corps, which is the founders and the main part of the organization, organizational membership. In 1978, it created the Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals in response to those in the healthcare industry that wanted to seek representation through the reputation that AFT had established. Education is a larger field than K-12, as a result of that, we have teachers and classified, instructors and classified in community colleges. We represent four-year faculty. We have a local at Western Oregon University, for example, and graduate teaching fellows at the University of Oregon. All of those are in the educational field or educational industry, as some may put it.
Okay.
That's
fine. Other questions,
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, does this bill need any work on it? Is it ready to go as it is?
I believe so. It's just a one-word change.
Yeah, right.
Thank you very much. Sure. As a...
As the parties are unable to get in to resolve any of their issues. On the other hand, this bar that we're proposing for 3 years would still leave open the entire, it would provide for the window period, 3 months out from the expiration of the third year, or the entire fourth year would still be an open period and not be within the contract bar.
Are there any other questions?
I have a fundamental question. AFTO is known as American Federation of Teachers, but as I look at the testimony, the copy you gave me, it includes all people, colleges, faculties, the fellow, four-year institution, child care workers, registered nurse, dental hygienist, technical employees, the name looks like a misleading to me.
Senator, through the chair, there one anecdotal comment is that if it went to school, it's our jurisdiction. But that aside, the American Federation of Teachers has five divisions and has expanded its jurisdiction and those that it organized from the late 1970s on. There is the K-12 teacher core, which is the founders and the main part of the organizational membership. In 1978, it created the Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals in response to those in the healthcare industry that wanted to seek representation through the reputation that AFT had established. Education is a larger field than K-12, as a result of that, we have teachers in classified, instructors in classified and community colleges. We represent four-year faculty. We have a local at Western Oregon University, for example, and graduate teaching fellows at the University of Oregon. All of those are in the educational field or educational industry, as some may put it.
Okay.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, does the school need any work on it? Is it ready to go as it is? I believe so. It's just a one-word change.
Okay. Right. Okay. Thank you very much. I don't see enough time to consider the president. What's the time still? So, public hearing on Senate Bill 564. Are you ready for the work session on Senate Bill 567?
Chair.
Thank you,
I move that we send Senate Bill 567 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. The work session on 567.
Now.
Oh, yes. I'm going to reopen a work session on
720. Mr. Chair, my apologies. We were probably a little hurried. The three people we had sitting in front of us were within about 20 seconds of agreeing that the way to go is to go right back to the -1 amendments and approve -1 because it really does get everything done. We even have somebody from the natural gas industry with us now, too, that agrees if you want to hear from him as to his rationale. And everybody's nodding. Everybody's smiling. Everybody is nodding. Therefore, I'd like to pass, I'd like to move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 720.
We'll move -1 amendments. 720.
Mr. Chair, could you explain to me what the -1 amendment does?
What's the -1 amendment?
Well, if you want to just read it as it comes on, it says, you know, any corporation, company, partnership, individual, or association of individuals. This is on page 2 on the back. Or association of individuals that furnishes natural gas, electricity, ethanol, methanol, methane, biodiesel, or other alternative fuel to any number of customers for use in motor vehicles and does not furnish any utility service described in paragraph A of this subsection, you know, it's not going to be regulated. They can sell that at the gas station. Okay, that's the idea.
Okay. Any other discussion on the
I'm falling in love with dash 4.
Don't do that.
I have you dash 4. Okay, another discussion. All right.
Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 720 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 720 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
For Senator Trow, I would say if somebody really loves Dash 4, they can case it over to the House. And
they'll love it that much.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Mitch.
Yes.
Senator Trow.
Yes.
Senator Lewis.
Yes.
Senator Lewis.
Yes.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Trow.
Aye.
Chair Duncan.
Aye. 720 as amended will be put to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Shields will carry the bill.
In the work session on Senate Bill 720.
Okay.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 12. Thank you, folks, for the good work.
Always trying to send people outside and have them work it out. Opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 1219. Margin.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1219 would permit the suspension of professional, occupational, or LLCC licenses, certificates, permits, or registration if the holder allows a child support obligor to work under the license, certificate, or permit. The support enforcement division, are they in the room? Oh, good. Yes.
Yes,
I'm Attorney General, and Ronell Schenkel from the Support Enforcement Division is supposed to be here at 4 o'clock as well as Senator Corcoran. That was my understanding, and I was just here as a resource to them.
Are we ready?
I think you're running ahead. This is unusual. You're ahead of schedule.
We are very efficient.
We operate that way. I'm going to, can you wait a few minutes? Of official kind. Okay, I'm going to
close the public hearing on
1219
and we'll reopen it when can I ask a question then on one of what we've already done?
Yes.
Okay. On this one about the park. Aren't we just, you know, spending time? Is that what we just decided for a second? I thought you were going to wait until 4.
If you have a question, I will be taking
a question. I'm not going to
go
too much. It's all right. I was noticing that we voted on the one, and I was looking at the amendment, Senate Bill 479. And I was looking in here, and I didn't see anything from, is it Portland that doesn't allow this? Some cities do not allow this.
Oh, Senator Shields was our man.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Shields, you want to... This is the work we're just in a recess for a second, just to say what
she wanted me one to. Okay, Senator Shield. They don't receive workers' comp. How can that be?
They're regarded as private contractors.
It's the way to get around, so you get no benefit.
But they don't let people putting in windows do that. But here there are these people. Okay, here's the other thing. I have another question. These, because I had lunch on Sunday with a woman that owns a group home, and she has people come in and work there. These aren't those workers?
These are not those workers. These are the workers that go into the homes of seniors and persons with disabilities to do service in their home.
Because those people are about ready to just give everybody back to the state and say, we can't find workers anymore, you do it. And the people own those group homes, they've about had it with the state. So I totally agree with you.
I think they've had a good deal. Now, I think the check goes to the individual from the state.
That's correct, Senator.
So they get it. And this is where it's misleading to many people because they think that they've employed because they...
I'll do whatever you want. Maybe you are just fine. Start with the one.
Okay, well, we may today. Okay. All right. Anything else you have for you? I hope you love that. You have a lot of support.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to... is it Lloyd Freight Mile? Tony, I'm sorry, Tony. Tony Freight Mile.
It's Craig Mile.
And Carla Smith. Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chairman Duncan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Craig Mile. I'm also a constituent as Senator Shannon. I'm a home care worker, and today I'm speaking on behalf of between 9,000 to 14,000 home care workers in the state of Oregon. We are supportive of Senate Bill 1114, which would recognize and reward home care workers based on length of service and completion of training programs. While it is a step in the right direction, there are deeper and more serious issues within the system of providing in-home care to seniors and people with disabilities this bill does not address. Senate Bill 1114 seeks to improve recruitment, retention, and wages of home care workers, as did Senate Bill 1155, which was passed in 1997 legislative session, giving home care workers a much-deserved raise in wages across the board. Meaningful solutions in the issues of recruitment and retention go much further than a dollar an hour or 25 cents an hour raise for training or longevity pay. Home care workers, by design, are excluded from any protections that are extended to other workers as a matter of normal employment practices. We are considered independent contractors, which means we are self-employed. Yet we fill out time cards, our hours, and our salary is set by the state. Our checks are sent to us from the state, and sometimes our paychecks are late. Sometimes our average wages are well below the minimum wage. We are not subject to OSHA. We are not covered by workers' compensation. We have no health insurance, disability insurance, or hope for economic security in our retirement years. In exchange for our services, we receive a set hourly wage, period, nothing more. Lack of the most basic workplace rights, we believe, are the major contributors to high turnover in our field, and in turn compromise the quality of care received by our clients. But there is something we receive for our services that needs to be part of this discussion, and it has to do with the inherent value of the services that we provide. It is the level of satisfaction, the sense of accomplishment, and compassion that we feel as we tend to Oregon's elderly and the disabled. Our clients, and I'd like you to visualize these with me, are elderly, frail, vulnerable. They are sometimes alone, and some do have families. Sometimes they are confused and disoriented. They are sometimes difficult and demanding. They are our parents, grandparents, and our families. Our clients are young, vibrant, enthusiastic, full of life, and disabled. Our clients live on the verge or in the abyss of poverty, and always they rely on their caregiver to allow them the ability to live in their own home. I would like you to really think about that. Having a choice of living in your own home. What a wonderful, reassuring choice we have offered our clients. The services that we provide to our clients go far beyond the cooking, cleaning, shopping that so often is used to describe our work. We do all those things, and yes, we do them even when our hours are cut back. We bathe and dress our clients. We monitor medications and administer them. We dress wounds, insert catheters, administer suppositories and enemas. We sleep lightly. We set our alarm clocks so we can turn our clients over in the middle of the night. We attend and we prevent bed sores. Our services delivered in an institutional setting would require that you were a licensed nurse or a CNA. But we rely on our clients to train us. Please understand the seriousness of what I have just stated. And yet SCSC's budget, which originally included CEP training, now has no money budgeted for training. So Senate Bill 1114, while well-intentioned from the standpoint of providing wage incentives for training, is an empty promise. There is no money in this budget to provide that training. And while we hold no ill will towards SDSD or the AAAs for the budgetary decisions, we do hold this legislative body responsible for spending priorities. Caring for people, whether they are school children or our grandparents, and how well we care for them defines who we are as a society in our communities, our state, and our nation. We are workers who do not have illusions. We do this work because it is our chosen profession, and we care about our clients. There is a value in the services that we provide that Senate Bill 1114 seeks to reward as home care workers, and we appreciate that recognition. Our only hope is that Senate Bill 1114 is just a beginning and not a Band-Aid. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'll answer questions if I can.
Sure, I just want to say that that's powerful testimony and well done, well given.
I would like to just add a small piece. There is a bill that was introduced in this legislative session. We thank those of you on the committee who have supported that bill. However, the bill is not even going to get a hearing. And I would think that during the course of this legislative session and on into the interim between sessions, that it is incumbent and important for our legislative body to be open to hearing the concerns that these workers are raising and the consumers of the care that these workers provide are bringing forward, because it is an issue that will continue to be exacerbated by a labor market where we are not able to recruit and retain people who are coming into our elderly and disabled people's homes, people who are extremely vulnerable. Without training, without lack of adequate resources to provide that training, to have any kind of ability to follow home care workers, to have a central registry, to have a place where home care workers and their clients can come together and try to be effective advocates for quality system. Oregon has a very good system of long-term care, but it is being built on the backs of home care workers who we are beginning to see an erosion in our ability to recruit and retain them. And that is the backbone of providing that quality service. As our population ages, we are going to become more and more reliant on home care workers to provide that care. And without acknowledging the value of the services these workers provide, we are going to make this system more and more fragile. And that is something that this legislative body is going to need to deal with eventually. These workers deserve the same rights as every other worker in this country. And that's the right to workers' compensation, the right to have a voice, the right to have an employer that they can sit down and resolve issues with. And that's part of the underlying problem that our system of care has right now.
Thank you. Stated very well. Yeah, thank you very much. Jackson Zimmer.
Here's what's your...
Is Lee Hazelwood, I may want to...
She's on vacation.
Good afternoon, Lee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission. We want to... I know we've visited all of you, and in that progress, we've given you a, a copy of the priority list, and one of the priority lists is Bill 1114. We want to emphasize that we worked hard last session to get additional funding, which in the normal course of time was not enough money. But I know in the governor's budget he did not fund this program, but we think it's a crucial part of the program. The governor's commission is composed of 21 people around the state of Oregon, one senator and one representative, which has not been appointed yet. But we can and do disagree with the governor, only because we don't feel there's enough funding for this type of program. So we strongly urge your support for this program, because it's a crucial part of the long-term care system in Oregon. Thank you very much, and any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jacqueline Zimmer, the Director of Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. I think I'll just be here to answer any questions because I believe my director, Jim Ridings, has presented testimony on our behalf today. Okay, thank you very much.
Are there any other individuals to testify on Senate Bill? Testify on 1114. Okay.
I'm sorry, I just can't got in and the conversation.
Okay, you bet we'll.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry that I didn't bring any prepared remarks with me tonight either, so I'm going to have to wing it. But okay. My name is Rick Berger, and I am president of the Oregon chapter of American Disabled for Attendant Programs Today, ADAPT. We're a national disability rights organization, and our main concern is on accessibility to community-based attendant care services. That is the main issue to that, and we've even sponsored legislature that's going to be before Congress. Thank you. That would basically do in every state what Oregon has done here. We are very concerned about the payments to people in the CEP program. To us, these folks are not just employees, are not just care providers. They are our partners in allowing us to live, and by live I mean really live, not have an existence where we're confined to a bed in a room with other people and basically being neglected and actually having a say in how our lives work, to having our freedom, to being able to go out and participate in the activities of everyday life, to even to gain employed. Oregon has started a program here under the amended state Medicaid plan called the Employment Initiative. I'm sure you're probably aware of it. It's one of BHR's new programs, and we think this is a great program. The problem is, without access to attendant care, that program might as well not exist, because without the attendant care, we won't be able to go to work under this plan. The problem is getting harder and harder to find trained, reliable people to be our partners in our lives like this. And I can't emphasize that partners more than I am. The program calls them client employed providers. And as their employers, people like me and other people with disabilities, well, we'd like to be able to impact their lives in the way most employers do. If you have a valuable employee, you want that person to be able to stay working for you, and you're going to do within reason whatever it takes to make that person comfortable, to show them how valuable they are to you. We can't do that with these folks. We can't even pay them workers' compensation insurance they're treated as independent contractors by the state, that insurance isn't taken out, isn't paid for. They can't afford, on what they're paid, they can't afford to go and buy the insurance themselves. And there with these folks like me around. I weigh about 250 pounds. If somebody's helping me transfer into bed, there's a risk that they may, hurt their backs or something. What are you going to tell them? So you hurt your back, well, you'll have to go on welfare, you'll have to become, get on disability, and you wind up being a client in the client employed provider program. One thing I want to point out is I'm hearing more and more that there are some people out there saying that the answer is to let private industry take over this program. Well, I couldn't be more opposed to that, because any long-term care program must be consumer-driven. We can't allow a profit-making entity to start dictating to us how many hours of care we need or how much our attendants are going to be paid. We need to continue to be able to impact these providers in ways that are positive for them and, in turn, positive for us. We view supporting these folks as a win-win situation. Anything that helps them in the long run helps us.
Okay. All right. Any
questions for Mr. Berger? Okay. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else that Yes. Good afternoon. And I'm quiet. I'm just getting closer, sorry. I apologize for not bringing prepared testimony either. My name is Lori Sitton, and I'm a client and employed provider program. Also serve on a number of different councils and committees with senior and disabled services, vocational rehabilitation, and wanted to impress upon you the importance of this program and how the client and employed provider program in the long-term care system in Oregon is such an integral part. And we need to recognize and acknowledge and reward these people for the work that they do, because it's so, at the current system, the way it's set up, I would have to say that they are really overworked and underpaid and really not valued as much as they should be and compensated in just a way as the way our society recognizes it, but in the dollar value. I have to say that living in the community, as a renter, I would carry renter's insurance in the hopes that if someone working in the home ever hurt themselves, I would claim they were a guest and they hurt themselves, truly. But that was just my own way of trying to assure that if someone really did hurt themselves and working with me, that they'd have some sort of avenue by which to get some treatment, because they really couldn't afford or didn't have any kind of long health insurance themselves. As someone who was injured at a relatively young age, and medical technology the way it is, I, as others, will live probably a normal lifespan, a number of years. I'm going to require someone to come in the home and help me or live with me. I would not want to live alone. Turn at night, get up in the morning, flip bath and take a shower, get dressed. Shopping, that I can do myself with assistance in the store, but food prep and laundry and housekeeping, all of this requires training. It takes a lot of energy. I can walk you through a day of trying to you put together an ad, and then when people call, screen, interview, orient, train, and then what we're looking at is a consumer-driven, consumer-directed care. So the individual comes in your home, and we have different idiosyncrasies and routines, but with some sort of basic training, people can kind of have an understanding. They know what the different supplies might be and how to
turn someone, how to get the different, there's different tricks and different things that can be, make the job a lot easier, that once someone knows how, it's a lot smoother, it works more quickly, it's a lot faster. And this is where, if someone is well trained, I'd be more than happy to dig in my pocket and shell out $15 an hour. If they can come in and get it done within 2 hours, what someone else might take four. What I'm trying to say is that with some sort of orientation training, it's good for the client, it's good for the provider. They are much more appreciated. They can come in, get the work done, and go. And I think the word employee is a real key piece here, because granted we have a support network to look independently in the community. You have family, friends, neighbors. These sorts of things are very... Also serve on a number of different councils and committees with senior and stable services, vocational rehabilitation, and wanted to impress upon you the importance of this program and how the client employed provider program in the long-term care system in Oregon is so such an integral part. And we need to recognize and acknowledge and reward these people for the work that they do, because it's so... At the current system, the way it's set up, I would have to say that they are really overworked and underpaid and really not valued as much as they should be, and compensated in just a way as the way our society recognizes it in the dollar value. I have to say that living in the community as a renter, I would carry renter's insurance in the hopes that if someone working in the home ever hurt themselves, I would claim they were a guest and they hurt themselves. Truly. But that was just my own way of trying to assure that if someone really did hurt themselves in working with me, that they'd have some sort of avenue by which to get some treatment, because they really couldn't afford or didn't have any kind of long health insurance themselves. As someone who was injured at a relatively young age, and medical technology the way it is, I, as others, will live probably a normal lifespan, a number of years. I'm going to require someone to come in the home and help me or live with me. I would not want to live alone. turn at night, get up in the morning, cook, bath, and take a shower, get dressed, shopping, that I can do myself with assistance in the store, but food prep and laundry and housekeeping, all of this requires training. It takes a lot of energy. I can walk you through a day of trying to you put together an ad, and then when people call, screen, interview, orient, train, and then what we're looking at is a consumer-driven, consumer-directed care. So the individual comes in your home, and we have different idiosyncrasies and routines, but with some sort of basic training, people can kind of have an understanding. They know what the different supplies might be and how to turn someone, how to get the different... There's different tricks and different things that can be make the job a lot easier, that once someone knows how, it's a lot smoother, it works more quickly, it's a lot faster. And this is where, if someone is well-trained, I'd be more than happy to dig in my pocket and shell out $15 an hour. If they can come in and get it done within 2 hours, what someone else might take four. What I'm trying to say is that with some sort of orientation training, it's good for the client, it's good for the provider. They are much more appreciated. They can come in, get the work done, and go. And I think the word employee is a real key piece here, because granted we have a support network to look independently in the community. You have family, friends, neighbors. These sorts of things are very critical to your living independently, but they're not someone who has to provide intimate care. This is an employee. It's a very delicate relationship. Of course, they'll be your friends. Well, maybe, maybe not. They are that you are relying on to assist you in living independently, to get up, to go to work, to go do whatever. But they're really not compensated justly. I think we need to have more funds for training as well as compensation. And I think the horse is dead now, but I hope that you understand. What I'm trying to say is it really is critical, and the population who needs assistance like this is growing. And Oregon's been leading the nation in many of these programs and services that others are trying to emulate, and I think we should keep up the good work, but we are lacking in this one area. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you're off.
Thank you. Hopefully. I appreciate that.
You've done it very well, and I think you're speaking to a committee that's pretty sympathetic and would love to do something. And keep at it. It's a long process, and I guess I've heard people say 114, 1114 doesn't really do it. I guess you just have to keep moving forward. We'll do that. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to say something?
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 114.
1114.
I'm
sorry. 1114.
Are you ready
to go to
the floor? I'm ready. I move Senate Bill
14. Work session on Senate Bill 1114.
I move Senate Bill 1114 to raise the means with a due pass recommendation.
And really due pass.
A really due pass.
Okay. Senator Shannon has moved Senate Bill 1114 to raise the means with a really due pass recommendation.
All right.
Is there any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Crowe.
Aye.
Chair Benson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 1114 will be sent to
a committee with a recommended due pass. I'm closing the work session.
Senate Bill 1114, and we'll be opening
the public hearing on Senate Bill 1219. Thank you, folks, for being with us today.
Good luck. Hard work, and some of you must be keep taking care of those workers. On Bill 1219, Lars.
Okay.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Ron L. Stankel with the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the state agencies within the Oregon Child Support Program, which is both the Director's Office, which is part of Department of Human Resources Adult Family Services section, and our division within the Department of Justice. We are here today on Senate Bill 1219, and our position is neutral. However, I'm here to provide you some information on the existing license extension program within Oregon related to child support, and a little bit of information on the work we've been doing with Senator Corcoran, who did sponsor this bill. Oregon originally enacted license suspension laws, the ability to suspend licenses for persons or against persons who fail to pay child support in some limited categories. The law was later amended in Oregon to include all categories, and this was in order to comply with federal regulations, and amended to include all types of licenses, certificates, permits, or registrations that a person is required by state law to possess in order to engage in an occupation or profession. Further then, in keeping with federal regulations, Oregon's laws were expanded to allow us to suspend driver's licenses. And last session, as part of the child support provisions of welfare reform, it was further expanded to include recreational licenses, which we have defined in Oregon as hunting and fishing licenses. So we've had a license suspension program for quite some time in Oregon, and gradually it has grown in keeping with the federal and the national requirements.
Sure. So we've had a long enough for us to have a track record. Is it effective?
Chair Duncan and Senator Cho, we believe it is, and I believe that you have been provided, along with my written testimony, a copy of some statistics. I will say an answer to that question. The intent of license suspension is not to suspend someone's license. The goal here is for us to use this as a tool to say, we are serious about having people pay their child support, and we can suspend your license, but the way you can avoid this is to enter into a payment agreement with us and then maintain that payment agreement. The target caseload here are the people that are self-employed, so we can't use our other more common child support tools such as wage withholding. They're self-employed, they run their own businesses, and we don't have some of the more immediate remedies, so we can get these people often to enter into payment agreements, and that is our goal, and that, I think, is what is reflected in the numbers that we gave you. The other thing I'll note on that supplemental document that's not on there is I had our caseload checked this month, and currently in our caseload, just support enforcement divisions, I didn't check the district attorney caseload, we have 610 obligors who were indicated as being self-employed. That means potentially any of them might fall subject to this type of a tool. Certainly some of them are paying parents, and so we would not use this tool, but potentially some of them may be available.
I went to a union meeting a couple weeks ago, and one of the things that several of the men complained about was that their employer, first off, that your agency would not allow them, they'd never missed a payment, anything, but would not allow them to send the check they had, you had, is it garnished, their wages, or garnished?
Wage withholding, they often refer to
it
as garnishment.
Yes, garnishment. Okay. And several of the employers had withheld it and didn't send it in. They paid them their wages, and they're kind of caught in the middle. They never saw the money. What do you do to those employers that do this? Because they can show you the bank, their check stubs of the weeks and weeks. And they call here, you say, you're behind, you haven't paid.
Chair Duncan and Senator Shannon, there are a variety of tools available depending on the case scenario. It is true that there are times when we send out an income withholding notice to an employer. The employer withholds the money from that person's paycheck but does not forward it into the program for a variety of reasons. Our first attempt, of course, would be a direct contact to the employer to make sure it wasn't an oversight, an error, that type of thing. But then there are further steps, there are fines, there could be up to a possible contempt action, because the law does say that child support will be collected through income withholding, and the notice to the employer does require them to comply with the laws.
Well, just a second. Can't they, if they have a... The law needs to be changed, because a mom or a dad that is faithful to pay it every month and have a canceled check, why are you making them go through you? Is it, I have, and they do too, it's like, is it full employment there or what? Because why do you need to be involved if these people are obeying the court order?
Chair Duncan and Senator Shannon, there are federal requirements that require orders that were entered or modified after a certain date. It was in 1994 that those orders are subject to to income withholding, and that is how child support shall be collected. There are some options for people to avoid the income withholding. One of those would be for them to set up an electronic transfer into the custodial parent's account. But in some manner, the majority of cases, not only in Oregon, but all of the states, will be making payment of some sort through a child support program so that there are records that the payments are being made.
Another question. Sure. You would violate federal law if the parent makes any arrangement to pay directly.
Chair Duncan and Senator Shannon, it would depend on the particular case, the date of the order, and the language of the law.
I mean, if
there
are
on the majority of the cases.
Get divorced today and make your payment. There's no provision under federal law that allows you to pay that and then...
There are scenarios where there are no state funds involved that people can write the divorce decree, for instance, that allows them to set up some sort of a payment outside of our process. But what happens is one of two things. Either the family, the children, more specifically, get involved in some sort of state program, welfare, foster care, juvenile care, or one of the parents, and it can be either parent asks for our services. People come into our system in a variety of manners, and if they're in our system and if their orders are eligible, the majority of them are collected through income withholding.
It was a long way that you went around to answer. My question was, then, it's not federal law that you must do income withholding.
Chair Duncan and Senator Shannon, there is a federal requirement that orders, new orders entered or modified after 1994 shall be collected through income withholding.
So it is against federal law.
There are a few scenarios in which that can be worked around.
And now when you, and that's another one, he said, well, really upset over this. But so I could tell them that if they're willing to have that check by the custodial parents bank, they can automatically take that from their account, or...
Chair Duncan and Senator Shannon, one of the requirements to be eligible for that particular process going into bank account is they have to be current on their child support. They cannot owe any arrears.
That's several more.
And then that would be an option for them. For people that have arrears, there's more difficulty because we're trying to not only collect that ongoing monthly support routinely, but get a little bit of a payment on the arrears. So there are criteria. What you could tell your constituent is that if they want to know about the options other than income withholding, that they should contact their local enforcement office, and that might be Support Enforcement Division, and it might be the district attorney, but call one of those officers. They can look at the case particulars and tell them what the options are. It is not an option on the majority of the cases, but it may be on some of them.
But if some clerk, I know you're not a clerk, probably attorney, but if some clerk says after 1994, the federal government requires, they don't, you know, they may not press like I am, because it's real hard to get a straight answer that, yes, if you have a record of paying your bills on time, you don't have to go through Support Enforcement and your employer. If you have a good record, I think out of all this, I'm hearing you say that if a non-custodial parent has a good financial record and pays their support, they can arrange it so it does not have to go through their employer, who may or may not send it on to you.
If I'm hearing you correctly, though, I'd be very cautious about that, because you'd have to go back to the court order.
Chair Duncan, the language in the court order is an important factor, and that's why I would suggest that you refer the constituents to us. And I would say that if you get a sense, if they call back and you get a sense that they got a flat answer and not a lot of discussion, that our division does have what we call a constituent desk, where it doesn't matter if it's a Support Enforcement Division case or a district attorney case, those people will help them understand better the answer that they're getting and work with the local office to work with that constituent.
Well, I just want to tell you that I wish this were true, but a man drove all the way over from La Grande because trying to get answers from you just didn't work, and this was a whole other case, and I went with him because it was a relative to get it all undone, and I just want to tell you that it was kind of, this is the way the law is, Bud, and yet when I went in, then everything was, all the options were explained and everything changed and all that. So I think they do need to be kinder and more informative to the people that are non-custodial.
Chair Duncan and Senator Shannon, I agree. Customer service for our division is a very big issue, and that is why we're maintaining a constituent help desk in order to try to remedy some of those issues. I'd be happy to provide the committee with the numbers to that desk. My number as well is available, and just to clarify, I am not an attorney. I am a lay representative from the division. I will highlight that we talked about, we do believe it is an effective tool. The bill as originally written had a focus on the other entities involved in licenses where it is, for instance, a business entity and there are multiple persons listed on the license or certificate, a partnership, a corporation, that type of thing. In working with Senator Corcoran on amendments that you will see reflected, I believe, in the -1 amendments. That is correct. We have shifted the focus back to that non-paying obligor. That's the person that we routinely are dealing with on the legal issues, and that would be our preference of the person we continue to deal with. So the amendments reflect a shift back to that person that is at issue rather than any other persons involved. You also see in the original bill there are some discussion in there about scenarios in which possibly our non-paying obligor had a license and the license is switched to some relative or someone to avoid the license suspension or because of the license suspension. We talked further with the senator about those scenarios, and they do occur from time to time, but we have tools available under existing statutes to take care of those scenarios, and so that language has been amended out of the bill. In essence, the original bill is drafted. That language has been taken out and is replaced with the language in the -1 amendment.
Chair Duncan,
Senator Troll, in essence, it is. The other thing that I will point out in reviewing those amendments, we discovered one more piece that we thought would be needed as a further amendment that are not yet reflected. And the reason for that is the process we've laid out in the dash one would allow us to work those cases, which we can under existing law, where a person has a license but is not individually held. They're a partner or they're part of a corporation, and currently our law says an individually held license. This bill would allow us to go a step further. There's some concern that there will be scenarios in which, depending on the amount of interest that our non-paying obligor has in the business, it could cause harm to the business. So you'll see attached to my testimony what we would offer as further amendments, and thinking this through a little bit further on the details. We believe it would be appropriate to give that obligor notice and to require that obligor to tell his or her partners or the other shareholders that they have received notice of a possible suspension that it could impact their business. We don't believe that a licensing entity would necessarily be able or be the appropriate agency to do that, and we're not able to notify the other shareholders because of the confidentiality of the child support record, so we would like to put that responsibility on the obligor, and we have those amendments drafted there for you. They haven't. Chair Duncan, that is correct. We just drafted these today and advised Senator Corcoran that we had found one more piece. His staff has. I do not know if he's had an opportunity to look at them.
Now, would these, if we did these, would we amend the dash one amendments with these amendments?
Chair Duncan, Senator Cho, yes, that is correct. It would be an addition to the dash one, and then the dash one would completely replace the original bill.
Too much government.
One of my questions here, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Back to the data here, occupational license, the driver suspension, suspension action.
Mm-hmm.
This is quite a bit.
Yes,
then how could they survive without a driver's license? You know, we are accomplishing some goals, but we are taking the OA license. How could they survive?
Chair Duncan, Senator Lamb, again, our goal is not to take the license away. At the point that we've suspended someone's driver's license, we have gone through a complete legal process of giving them notice, giving them opportunity for hearings, and giving them several opportunities to enter into a payment agreement and start paying on their child support. And these are people that simply don't or won't for some reason. I do not know how they go about getting to and from work, for instance, at that point. But I can tell you that at the point that they begin making payments again, their license will be able to be reinstated. I would also point out that you can see some numbers here about the number of notices we send out, the payment agreements, and the licenses we actually suspend. In our caseload, I mentioned to you that we have this month 610 obligors that are coded as self-employed. To put that in a little bit of perspective, in our caseload this month, we have almost 128,000 cases. So this is not by any means the majority of the cases that we're dealing with this on.
It's a minor.
Pay the child support.
Chair Duncan, I think Senator Corcoran would reflect the same information, and that is why I understand he has brought the bill forward. I do feel responsible for telling you one final thing, and we have advice, Senator Corcoran, of this. Our federal requirements require us to have the ability to suspend individually held licenses. Our program did not bring forward this concept because Oregon would actually be saying we're willing to take this process one step further than the federal government has mandated. That is absolutely your decision to do so, but that is why the program is neutral on the bill. We don't have a requirement to get to these partnerships and corporations, but certainly we acknowledge that there are cases where this is an issue and we haven't been able to use this remedy.
Well, there are a lot of kids involved in this thing. You just look at this. Look at this. The number of people per month. And if you count that up, the number of
children. Duncan, that is correct. And our average case size does reflect two children. So when I indicated that we currently have almost 228,000, just in our portion of the case, well, we are talking about a large number of families.
So it's 228,000
cases. Currently in the support and enforcement division. There are 600 of them currently that we know that obligor is self-employed. There may be some that we're not aware of yet. And self-employed only ties into the professional license. Anybody could be subject to the driver license suspension, of course, if they have a driver's license. So the target here is rather on the self-employed. Those are the types of people that would be a part of a business, a partnership, a shareholder.
How far behind do they have to get before you drift your business license?
I believe that the statute says, and I can look to see if my counsel has the statute before her, but I believe it says you have to be at least 3 months and $2,500 in arrears. The committee administrator is nodding. She may also have the statute in front of her.
And that's a real impact on the family. Yeah. Any other questions?
Thank you so much.
Are you going to be here for a few minutes? Good afternoon. I'm trying to move the lawn now, which is one more day. I'm going to get it all out today. This is our last week.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barb Hutchison from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I was not really familiar at all with this bill until, I don't know, 10:30 or 11 o'clock this morning, and have gotten from the committee administrator the dash ones. And our staff has, at this point, not had an opportunity to look at these proposed amendments, the dash ones. I think that their initial hit was it was going to create a big hearings process, and we were going to have to be figuring out intent of licensees and try to find people in, you know, through a computer system that right now doesn't exist. So they were very worried about this. Our commissioners are not even aware of this bill at this point, so we have no formal position on this. In talking to Senator Corcoran and counsel for this program, I can take these back to staff. I think that our biggest issue is that right now we have a budget proposal before this session that would put a licensing system, a computer system in place for the Liquor Commission so that we indeed can track our licensees. Right now, all of our licensees, if you can believe this, are on pieces of paper and on microfiche. We can get through a very good computer system all of our service permittees. So anybody that's out there serving alcohol in a licensed establishment, we can find them very easily. Right now, our issue is, can we really find these people if we need to? And to our knowledge, we have not been asked to suspend a license, and this bill has been in effect for 4 years. Is that correct? Over 4 years, and we've
okay.
never been.
May I suggest that you both get together and probably those men should come back here on Thursday. And we're moving fast, which means that you guys.
Sir Duncan, member of the committee, I will do that, and I have already called our deputy director to make her aware of this so that she can get a hold of our attorney general, who can in turn call counsel.
I'm going to Senator Corcoran, too. Before people come back in, I want you guys to have gotten together beforehand. We don't want to do it here. I'm not sure.
Senator Duncan, we can make that happen.
All right. Okay, fine. We'll look forward to seeing you on Thursday with everything prepared and ready to go just for a quick work session. Yeah. That's it. I didn't want to rush you any. Okay. Anyone else want to sign this bill? I'm closing the public hearing on 12/19. Okay, and I am now going to open a short session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 857. 857. Okay, Jacqueline, so when
then you want to run the same time?
Sure.
We'll just keep the one here.
Chair, members of the committee, Jacqueline Zimmer, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. We're here today basically just to probably answer any questions you might have. As you know, we're doing they redid the fiscal impact on this particular bill so that it showed no fiscal impact this session. Biennium. It does show the fiscal impact next biennium, which we knew would occur. And
Okay, you're supposed to. Is this your bill?
It's our bill. All right, Senator Shields.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856, which we passed out a while ago and sent to Ways and Means, is similar to this bill, but the fiscal impact is for this biennium, not next biennium. The dash one amendment to Senate Bill 857 would have the fiscal impact for next biennium. The fiscal impact is right now $4.2 million for the next biennium. At least that's what it says on our fiscal with the dash one amendment. So this bill would have to be sent to Ways and Means. It's just another option out there for Ways and Means to look at.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 857 and open a work session on 857 and then take discussion.
Are you ready to move it to Ways and Means?
That's what the committee has to do because of the fiscal impact for the next client.
You need to amend it first.
Yes. You have to adopt the dash one.
Okay, I'll move the dash one.
Move the dash one amendment. Discussion? Okay. Dash one amendment to adopt.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 857 as amended to the Ways and Means.
Senator Cole, move 857 as amended to. I'm closing the public hearing on 12-19. Okay, and I am now going to open a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 857. 857. Okay. Jacqueline, so when
Jenny, you want to say time?
Sure.
We'll just keep the one here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jacqueline Zimmer, Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. We're here today basically just to probably answer any questions you might have. As you know, we're doing a they redid the fiscal impact on this particular bill so that it showed no fiscal impact this session, this biennium. It does show the fiscal impact the next biennium, which we knew would occur.
Okay, you're supposed to. Is this your bill?
It's our bill.
Right.
Right, Senator Shields.
Dash one amendment?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856, which we passed out a while ago and sent to Ways and Means, is similar to this bill, but the fiscal impact is for this biennium, not next biennium. The dash one amendment to Senate Bill 857 would have the fiscal impact for next biennium. The fiscal impact is right now $4.2 million for the next biennium. At least that's what it says on our fiscal with the dash one amendment. So this bill would have to be sent to Ways and Means. It's just another option out there for Ways and Means to look at.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 857 and open a work session on 857 and then take discussion.
Yes,
are you ready to move it to Ways and Means?
That's what the committee has to do because of the fiscal impact for the next biennium.
You need to amend it first.
Yes.
You have to adopt the dash one.
Okay. I'll move the dash one.
Move the dash one amendment. Discussion?
Okay.
Dash one amendments are adopted.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 857 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Cole, move 857 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a new dash recommendation.
He seeks to not affect the biennial. Why do we send to Ways and Means at this time? Because we haven't extended the time anyway.
Well,
what's the amount?
It does have a fiscal impact, and it is that the fiscal impact is delayed beyond this time, but it does have a significant fiscal impact, and I don't think we know what our budget situation will be in 2 years. You could send it down to the floor, it would risk not passing on the floor, is my guess,
probably
or be sent to Ways and Means from the floor. That's probably what would happen.
Okay.
I'd just like to know what the proper procedure, since it doesn't affect his coming by any and following by any. We have 1% rate and intervene even though we have it at this time, so they have to go to the price of this process. I'd like to find out what the logical process we have.
Okay. I
totally love
your stuff. I hate to stop here because I think there's a commitment on the part of
Mr. Shields. Do you want us to go to the floor?
Well, you know, I've been talking to Neil Bryant and Barbara Ross and others in that Ways and Means Committee about every day, and I haven't even had time to tell these guys that talked to Gary Weeks today. And you know, we're dealing with the other end, the request for $3.9 million this biennium, and they're saying, you know, maybe we can get these folks to $2 million this time. That was one of the comments today. And so, you know, to me, 857 on top of 856 is going to bump up against it, you know, and I don't know, maybe they should be together and dealt with as one piece. Maybe they should be kept apart so that it helps get where we want to go this time.
Does it make sense to keep this bill in committee?
Well, not too long.
If you want it to go to the floor.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, this bill really deals with the methodology. We have got to get the methodology portion fixed this particular session so that we don't have to keep coming back for this every single session. So, on one hand, I'd like to see this bill go to the floor. I think we have the votes to move it out and to fix the math. And I think it's possible that Ways and Means will, at some point, put some money towards the problem this particular session. And if we end up just putting money towards the problem but we don't fix the methodology, we'll be right back where we were in the next session.
Does the bill, as it is now, fix the problem?
It fixes the sort of the math problem, but it doesn't give us the money that we need. Yeah. We have to continue to work on the money problem through Ways and Means.
That's what I'm wondering before. In this form, Matt,
it could. If it doesn't come out of Ways and Means, then we haven't accomplished either goal. We haven't fixed the methodology, nor have we gotten the funding. So that's the part that, that's why we created two bills, one to make sure that we fix the methodology and the other to see if we could fix the methodology and money. Well, there's no money this particular session.
That's what I'm saying.
No, it's tricky in that this bill says there's no money this session, but it's possible that we will get money this session.
And
if we were missing this, you got a vote. That's no.
if you were carrying the bill, you'd say it's the methodology we're trying to hear. Don't worry about these blank spots. And here's the dollar amount, and it won't has no fiscal impact for the 99.1 fiscal year.
This is a different approach, but I think that we ought to send it to the floor, and all four of us ought to carry it. And that would give us four cracks at explaining why it doesn't have a fiscal impact this time, but there's a mathematical problem. And we could also explain the problem in Clackamas County, you know, the equity question. And is the same equity problem hit your county, Claire?
I don't know. I'm not sure that I know what the equity problem
the,
is.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, Cascades West is estimating that in this biennium, we will have a $1.2 million shortfall. If that occurs, we've already talked with our board, and this fall, we will appoint a committee to discuss what our relationship will be with the state as it relates to senior disabled services. as of July 1st, 2000.
And has explained that to me. I just wasn't remembering.
And Senator Trow, what that means is literally that they are saying they could give those county employees back to the state, back to SDSD. So all four of us are in counties that are affected by this, which is my rationale for having all four of us here to bill.
That sounds okay.
It doesn't say it's the fiscal impact
that's attached to it.
It's no, the other bill that has the blank state. You don't have it.
We don't have it.
No,
it
doesn't. Okay.
Well, you saw it since the chair. Yeah, you send this away from me. It is like there's nothing of anything like
it. For sure.
And when you send the floor, you flip it, test it, and the post of house, then they can come back later next biennium. We have this bill, you're obliged to put
it. Sure. Senator, just like the Lieutenant Governor was this morning. Really, I'm just saying,
it has no impact this time.
No, but there was no fiscal impact for this biennium.
Sure.
All right. And it was laying the groundwork, and that's what this would be.
Sheriff, if I could, I want to be really clear, though. There's no fiscal impact tied to this, but if Ways and Means offers us money, we're going to take it.
You'd be happy to.
And if we keep doing this, next biennium, we'll have to pay $850.
You guys will have to vote for it.
All right. We're in work session. I'm going to...
The bill needs to be amended.
Move
the dash one.
Okay, dash one
amendment
to move by the Senate. Always in discussion.
One amendments are adopted.
Okay, Senator Shields, move your bill to the floor.
Let us move Senate Bill 857 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That goes to what it means.
That's the discussion.
857 is amended to move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll.
I don't know.
Aye.
Senator Shannon. Is it a good bill? I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, you're making it equal.
You're going to help to carry us.
We all are.
You're going to tell about your county and the problems there.
That's
aye.
Did you vote aye? I voted aye.
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
Senate Bill
57 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carriers will be. Should we do it?
Sure.
All right. The carriers will be. Shields. Shannon. Duncan.
Stowe.
And
Lynn. All right.
Thank you. I'm going to tell the majority leader on you. He said short speeches, remember.
Don't talk to me.
We'll get it back.
All right. It'll be short.
This is a good bill, and we're doing the right thing. We really are.
Is there anything else to come before the committee?
I do. I have something. You want to close that work session?
Close the work session on Senate Bill 857.
Okay. I had to run out. Somebody flagged me, but I was thinking. And what I'm thinking about is that one where they do wage withholding. They miss the 600. And so this company is a partnership, and the one partner is very conscientious. They employ 20 people, 10 of them have wage withholding. And so because this one man, we'll just say it's a man, is 3 months behind, then 20 people are shut down and 10 of them get behind because they don't have work.
I don't understand.
Okay. You're going to take away the business license of a partner because one of the partners is being a deadbeat. And so without a business license, they shut down. And their 20 employees are out of work. And 10 of those are having wage withholding, so their cumulative 25 kids can get their child support. Now, because this one guy is a bad apple, 25 kids aren't going to get
their withholdings that week. And I think that if you're getting 228,000, that I just think we need to look at the risk involved.
I think they have discretion, though, and they may or may not do that, and they can negotiate with that one person who ought to feel some responsibility.
Well, this is aimed at that person. This is aimed at those self-employed or partnerships. This whole bill is targeted to partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted that concern.
During the
Go ahead.